that our government, our president, our minister, and everyone else get someone who has some, in quotes, educated, kind of scholarly analysis of developments that are there in the world. Otherwise, as a country, you wouldn't cope. You wouldn't know what to do, what not to do, what to say, what not to say. And with that, you're most welcome, and I must greet again our officials, Lubabalo, Sister Nao, where is she? Yes, and thank you very much. We are back with you. I think with that, we want to hand over to the chair. Perhaps let's introduce ourselves, because yeah, we may need to do that. Let's start with Honorable Bachman. Who are you?
Chair, thank you very much. I'm the alternate for the Democratic Alliance on International Relations, and my name is Darren Bergman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair. My name is Sengiwe Hlophe. I'm the member of this committee from EFF.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Thandiwe Kenye from the African National Congress. Thank you.
Hey, good morning. My name is Gina Olaputi from the African National Congress. Thank you.
I'm Pekisizwe Khatebe, a member of the ANC.
We are all members of this committee. Eh? I'm Sipho Sezwe Masango, a member of this committee and chairperson of the committee. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Aziz Bahad. I'm the chair of SACAWA.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Tepo, and my surname is Mashiane, and I'm a member of SACAWA. Thank you very much.
My name is Khabu Mahoy. I'm the team DG for that.
Thank you, Chair Matujo, Deputy Director General at DECO. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, everybody. I'm Fadel Nasiruddin, Chief Director for Mediation Support, Policy Research and Analysis at the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. Vasu Gowenden, member of SACWA.
Good morning, Chair. Maxi Skuman, also a member of SACWA.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Jimmy Kojana, from member of the SACAWA.
Are we done? Yeah. Thank you very much. Chair, I want to defer to you for a presentation or opening remarks, ably assisted by your team. Over to you.
Thanks, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. We must apologize. We were supposed to have been joined by a few more. They either been caught up travel arrangements or, I mean, caught up at the airports. Hopefully they'll still come. Dear colleagues of the Portfolio Committee, as you just mentioned, Chair, it was in 2010 that the Minister of DECO informed Parliament of government's intention to establish the South African Council on Foreign Relations as an advisory body to the minister. As you also know, it took a long process for SACAWA to be launched, and finally, SACAWA was launched in 2015, so it took 5 years, which meant that there was a lot of consultation about applications and all. It had to go through many processes before the members of SACAWA were nominated by the minister to cabinet. And as you know, SACAWA is a consultative forum to the minister, and we are 25 academics, business, trade unions, and representatives of civil society. And our mandate is to interact with DECO, which is our basic support structures, and of course, to intensify our interaction with Parliament through the Portfolio Committee and through other structures. And indeed, we have to reach out to civil society. No, I won't be talking. I'll talk to the presentation. Because you've got it in your paper. It's a very formalistic presentation. I better just talk to it. So as I was saying, our task in interaction with various aspects of Parliament, DECO and civil society is to discuss the global political and international trends and its impact on international relations. We are expected to provide a frank, critical and non-partisan assessment of the formulation and implementation of South Africa's foreign policy and to identify key emerging trends which should help the Minister and Dekawa to reconsider or consider approaches on issues that need some policy positions. And indeed, Sakawa has a task of assisting the Minister and Durko as it plans for its annual international relations agenda. Now, we are also expected to provide a platform for the generation of public debates on foreign policy and the conduct of international relations. So it's two things, not just to analyze, but to try to assess how is DECO implementing the policies that government has taken and to try to constructively see whether we are meeting the expectations of the situation that demands the actions that we have identified. And we hope we can bring the voice of civil society to the foreign policy process and, indeed reflect the importance for non-state actors to influence foreign policy. As you know, that throughout the world and because of the information technology, non-state actors are playing a major role in influencing foreign policy, even of the major countries. And we believe Sakawa should then provide such a platform and a bridge between our civil society organizations and other sectors of our society. And of course, we are also supposed to, as I said, do regular review of our foreign policy and its implementation. And indeed, the importance, as we discussed a little yesterday, to assess whether government structures have the capacity to implement the policies we adopt in this very complex and changing world situation. We have identified our priorities for our work, which includes, one, global political and economic trends and its impact on international relations, two, the African agenda, including poverty, inequality, and development, regional integration, peace and security, and the AU 2063 agenda. Three, we have to analyze the growth of emerging powers, especially China, and in the context of South-South cooperation, and indeed see what the impact of this is on South Africa and Africa as a whole. Four, we have to very constructively look at our existing relations with the North and see where we have some challenges and how we can improve our relations with the Northern, the more developed countries. Five, we have to look at global governance, including the restructuring of the United Nations Security Council and the General Assembly, and indeed the Bretton Woods institutions, that is the World Bank and the IMF. Six, economic diplomacy is vital to the future of our own development in South Africa, and we have to analyze whether our work in economic diplomacy is meeting the needs of our domestic programs. Seven, the Middle East process is very important, and we have to see how that impacts on the regional situation in the Middle East and North Africa and its impact on sub-Saharan Africa. Eight, which is a new phenomenon but one of the most dangerous phenomena, the growth of extremism and terrorism, and indeed its internationalization. because as we must discuss, terrorism in the Middle East and North Africa is now reaching our shores, and indeed, as you've seen, it is now a threat in almost all major developed countries too. And our flagship program will be an annual Johnny Macatini dialogue forum, which will deal with, every year, identified key international relations issues. Now, we do believe, in the 1 year of our existence, that it is critical to ensure that South Africa's government and all structures of it, parliament, all structures of it, and non-governmental institutions encourage open and critical discussion, which challenges all sectors of our society to question our own assumptions and to defend positions with intellectual vigor and concrete facts. There is a tendency in many countries in think tanks, and they think that they know what is happening, and there is not sufficient intellectual debate with them to start challenging some of the perspectives which is very common, and I want to believe even on the African continent. We must answer the question, are we able to produce knowledge that influences policy makers and policies? Because it's no use just studying, no use discussing, unless we understand how does this knowledge influence policy and policy makers. And indeed, I believe that together with our partners, which is Portfolio Committee as well, we must contribute to the debate on what we consider we know to influence policy and what the reality is. By this I mean is too many people think we have the answers. And the truth is that it does not meet the realistic objectives in situation that we find ourselves in. All this means that we must know what knowledge our policymakers need to make informed foreign policy decisions. There are sometimes a lot of criticisms of our foreign policy. Sometimes there might be some truths that not sufficient understanding exists in why that policy came about. But also we must assess whether the criticisms are based on factual information and a proper study of what is being criticized. And we must analyze whether government's foreign policy and interventions are made on the basis of extant knowledge. Because many governments are making foreign policy not based on extant knowledge, and this is why it is not effective in influencing any major event internationally. This demands that together with the Portfolio Committee, that we contribute to what is basically called the democratization, the management and use of knowledge to impact on a better understanding of foreign policy and its implementation. And it is very important for the Portfolio Committee, like other structures, to consider options that takes into consideration and gives the government necessary flexibility to timeously respond to developments that was not foreseen, given the limitation of extant knowledge. And government sometimes has to act and give immediate responsibility. And it's important for us on hindsight to reflect on whether that reality enabled government to make the correct decisions. And indeed, I must say, it is time in the complex world situation we find ourselves is to start thinking outside the box and try to predict and analyze potential new developments. We believe that all sectors of government, parliament, and civil society must appreciate that every government in the world have to take into consideration the global realities in which we work. And these realities include A, it is now well documented and nobody contests it, that after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and socialism, whether we agreed with it or not, in Europe, there emerged a unipolar world with one political, economic, and military superpower. And after the 9/11 attacks against the U.S., unprecedented in our history, all governments' foreign policies had to come to grips with policies of exceptionalism, increased defense spending, disregard of international law, the weakening of the United Nations Security Council, increasing resort to the coalitions of the willing without going through the UN Security Council, and the growing tendency on the part of many countries to reduce the complex and interrelated problems that the world faces today to very narrow national interests and indeed a militaristic approach to diplomacy. B, as we try to deal with these problems in South Africa and Africa, we must accept that there is a universal lack of leadership and governance throughout the world, both at the governmental and non-governmental levels, and that includes businesses, unions, civil society. And all countries are experiencing the crisis of corruption, abuse of state power and resources, alienation from society, identity crisis, mistrust of politicians, captains of industry and authority generally. This is now a world phenomenon. And I think recently the British decision to leave the EU, Brexit, and the latest presidential election in the US is a confirmation of this reality, where millions of people in the U.S. were rejecting what they call authority, what they were calling Washington, and that's the only, not the only, but that's a very important reason to explain the present, the results of the latest presidential elections in the USA. B, the world, not only us in Africa, is experiencing the unprecedented pace of globalization, information technology, and the dominance of the neoliberal ideology, resulting in growing inequality within countries and between countries. And this came up very strongly in the US elections. A Credit Suisse report recently found that 1% of the richest in the world have as much as wealth as half of the poorest in the world. And OECD, which is a European Union-driven organization, report found that in 34 of its member states, inequality today has reached new levels. Now, clearly this is unsustainable. And the World Bank concluded that new liberal policies have been oversold and it has failed. The Secretary General of the OECD said, I quote, "We have reached a tipping point," unquote. See, since 1977, the world continues to experience a deepening financial crisis, and there's no certainty on how to deal with this crisis. Rothschild, one of the richest men in the world, recently said, I quote, "The Western central banks are conducting the greatest experiment in monetary policy, with consequences impossible to predict," unquote. Now, if the richest grouping of people in the world think that these central banks are experimenting with financial policies with difficult to predict what's going to happen, the consequences, then I think we must begin to prepare for the worst. D, capital flights. A recent Economic Commission on Africa on the illegal flow of capital from Africa concluded that the illegal flow of capital from Africa conservatively costs Africa more than $50 billion a year. Now, if we think that we are losing $50 billion a year from Africa illegally, then, and this is the report supported by almost all major developed countries who gave full cooperation to deal with this phenomenon, then if we begin to block that illegal flow, we won't need the assistance that we have been promised and never given by so many countries in the world. And I do believe at every level we must study this Economic Commission report on Africa more fully since it is accepted by all major countries, and begin to identify how we deal from it. The other major problem we in Africa face is the brain drain. Since 1990, Africa has been losing 20,000 professionals a year, and the World Health Organization estimates that if this trend continues in 25 years, Africa will be empty of brains, unquote. Now, can you begin to imagine a continent empty of brains? And it's not us who are accused of being ideologues saying this. This is the World Health Organization. Now, you add to this the fact that we in Africa are losing 20,000 professionals a year. And this is why the World Health Organization can conclude that in 25 years we will be a continent without brains. Now you add to this short list that I have mentioned, rapid urbanization, the youth bubble, demography, climate change, water and energy crisis, unprecedented migration from conflict areas in Sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, and now Syria and elsewhere, which has resulted in the rise of religious fundamentalism, racism, xenophobia, narrow nationalism, right-wing and neo-fascist organization in Europe and North Africa, by the way, and extremism and terrorism, which, as I said earlier, is leading to the disregard of international law and the European Union approach to, which is an unprecedented level of immigration, has violated every tenet of humanitarian and international law. And they accept that they have done that, and there's a crisis of conscience in many of the governments in Europe and elsewhere. And I think the very fact that extremist and neo-fascist organizations in Europe are taking such an excited position on the victory of Trump, I don't know what they base it, but is an indication that we have much more challenges coming in on the European continent and elsewhere. And we're not immune from this, because Europe is one of our biggest economic partner. Europe is our biggest developmental partner. And what happens in Europe, we cannot ignore. Of course, there's another phenomenon, the rising, as I said, of emerging economies, especially China, South Korea. But this has been met by what Obama administration calls the policy of the Asian pivot. The Asian pivot means that they have seen China as a potential threat to U.S. interests in that part of the world. So that's going to increase the tensions as we go along. So it is my belief that all these developments are threats to regional and international peace and security that we have not seen since the pre-Second World War period. And indeed, as I said, there is a militarization of diplomacy. And I like to quote the New York Times op-ed in 2013, which it said, diplomacy is dead. Now, the New York Times is not a radical paper. It's a paper speaking on behalf of the U.S. administration. And it noted that this is an age of impatience, simple-mindedness, and unwillingness to talk to bad guys, and human rights are in fashion. And the space for realist statesmanship has diminished. So it's an indication, not statements of just wishful thinking, that there's sufficient information telling you that even diplomats are less involved in decision making on relations between country to country than the intelligence agencies and the military. I don't know, our continent, including South Africa, whether that's also become a reality, but we will try to look at that, and we hope that others will try to look at that. Diplomats must be given the job that they're supposed to do, because diplomacy is a special art, and diplomacy is a substitute for war. Now, I'm sure colleagues here have read the UK Chilcot, the recent UK Chilcot report on Iraq, and the UK Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee report on Libya. You add to that the Hillary Clinton documents, the WikiLeaks documents, the Snowden reports, and the views of many governments and think tanks. And you can see there is a sometimes reluctant confirmation that the foreign policies of major countries has led to world instability, conflicts, regime change, and growing anti-Western sentiments. Given the realities that I have mentioned, one has to ask why the world is so silent when major countries are implementing policies that are threatening the very existence of humanity. It's very difficult to understand, including in our country, including in other African countries. There is not a sufficient strong voice to challenge what is happening in the international, global, economic and political order. Now let me venture one idea in this. It's not the only idea. But I refer you all to the 1961 statement by the US President, then President Eisenhower, who warned that, I'm going to quote, "The concentration of illegitimate social power in the military-industrial complex, whose total influence, economic, political, and even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, and every office of the federal government, and the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded," unquote. Now that was President Eisenhower in 1961. It is our view that today, perception management, commonly known as propaganda or brainwashing, has reached unprecedented levels. Many government documents, and as I mentioned, the recent Chilcot and Joint British Parliamentary Committee, has confirmed that governments regard the control and manipulation of information as soft power weapon, which merges psychological operations, propaganda, and public affairs as what they call strategic communications, and that it is used to influence target population state of mind and shaping people's perceptions of normal element of information policy. So what it indicates? I think all major powers, and that might even include not sufficient information on the Russians and Chinese element, but I think all major powers use perception management as an instrument of soft power. So, this is a terrain of struggle. And I think we must not see it as absolute, that the newspapers can control all thinking. As you have seen, Trump defeated the entire media perception management, unprecedented in the USA. And Sanders, by the way, he was defeated, I think, by other forces. But he was getting 60% of the vote despite total media opposition, even from his party media against him. So it's not absolute that the management of media is a given. It's a terrain of struggle that we must fight on. So it is, again, our view that we must understand the importance of social media better and information technology, and understand that the media on its own cannot totally control thinking, and there are ways to challenge the mass media generally and think tanks. And therefore we must critically assess information we get and always seek alternative perspectives. It is unfortunate that some believe that criticisms of the major countries' foreign policies is ideologically driven and reflects hostility to such countries. I want to contend that in times of crisis, silence is tantamount to support in bad policies. It is my own experience that major countries in diplomatic areas, diplomatically, if you raise these issues openly and frankly, they might not agree with you, but at least they would have frankly heard an alternative view that we are putting. And I believe there was a time when Africa was able to put alternative perspectives and influence the major powers in certain policy positions. I think we must now reach that situation again. So let me, by ending, say that these are challenges. We think we will continue to any country's policies, including our own, constructively criticize where we think things are going wrong. And indeed, we must do it with concrete facts and reasoned arguments. I think time for slogans in this complex situation is over. Time for dogmatic interpretation is over. And I believe we have the capacity, both in the parties that are here and in Sakawa, to begin to do this in a much more organized and collective way. I hope that this will help us when we do more research, and as we said, Sakawa wants to cooperate much more, become another instrument to help Parliament and its various structures to really begin to analyze the world situations better, and that I think if we do this properly, we can have a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. Nowhere else in the world is the foreign policy of a country debated publicly where it's different. They try to come to a common bipartisan approach on issues that impact on the national interests of our country. And I do hope that the parties in the portfolio committee, after constructive discussion with lots of information given, will now emerge on many issues with a bipartisan approach so that we do advance our own national interests in the broad context as we interpret it. With that, I hope we can cooperate better, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, former Deputy Minister of Foreign Relations, Mr. Pahai. Thank you very much for your input. We are not voting here, Mrs. Shope. Bunga Shaya is under together with us. It's not standing for office.
My favorite person in the world.
Oh, thank you so very much. I am not sure whether I should invite any further input and or invite comments and questions from the members so that when we then respond, we can then respond as a team. I think that will be better managed that way. And before we get into that, I want to, we've been strengthened, as the quarter would always say, in his other life, of course. We've been strengthened by the presence of three more members. Honorable Dudley, can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you. Sorry, I'll be in and out.
Yeah, but who are you?
Sorry, I'm a member of parliament for the last 18 almost years. Thank you.
Harappa?
Morning, Chair. I'm sabotaged here.
Thank you.
We'll try and use the other one. But
doing here. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, SACWA. It's good to be here once more. It's Honorable Stephen Mukalapo, Member of Parliament and Member of this committee. My name is Mbumlola.
No, a very prominent Mbumlola. Which one are you? Who called out all the colors? Who knows which one I'm more?
Oh,
yeah. This one is Advocate Lawyer from Mbumlola. They are not Rara. They pay short. No, that's why I'm saying there's another Mbumlola. You must explain which one he is. He's a member of this committee. And with that, I want to invite comments from members. Honorable Bergman, you want to put it in there? Bergman? No, others could follow. I'm just looking for paper to note. Over to you, around that one. Okay, let me note the hand, brother.
Thanks, Chair. Just to say to the ex-minister Fahad that I'm also a fan of yours. I remember one of the first ministers I met was when I was the youth leader of the DP, and the funniest speech I heard at Empress Palace was actually Minister Fahad. But just to get quite serious, to ask a few, to make a few points. The first one, and please, I might delve a little bit on the obscure, but I'll bring it back. But if we look at our relationship with the UN and our intention of trying to get a permanent seat on the UN, and then we look at our decision on the ICC courts and that, are we sending mixed messages out in international relations in terms of the type of player that we would like to be? And in your humble opinion, what would be the correct message to ensure that we're on message, so to speak? Again, your prominent job in terms of Middle East peacekeeping, I think this could be a nice briefing for us today. It's just a slight briefing, nothing too elaborate. But maybe just to give us a progress report on how the efforts from both of you are going in terms of this. In terms of, I'm one of the people that talk about internal politics as a way to try and guard against the currency fluctuations, and a lot of our internal politics, you touched on it in saying that seeing the international elections, both in America and Europe, seeing a lot of nationalism taking place and pride, returning to nationalism. I think it's important that race is a factor and that we make sure that we don't divide. We've got three parties that are consistently talking around race, and all three messages always seem to divide, although the one might sound as it's trying to unify, the other one might sound as almost hate speech and threatening minorities. Somewhere along the line, these messages are sending out mixed signals. So when you look at things like brain drain, and you look at things like exorbitant money, $50 billion leaving our shores, these are the kind of things that if we could control that. How do you see us, would you see that as potentially controlling a lot of both the brain drain and the illegal exits of money? I was just in an international conference now where they said that climate change is completely underestimated in terms of what it's going to do for refugees in it. Now, if you take that, South Africa probably has the highest amount of intake And you know, Europe's problems are nothing compared in terms of the amount that we take in, and you'd think that Europe is the biggest receiver. How, in your opinion, how's climate change going to affect that? Are we going to be a bigger beneficiary, or should we be, you know, how should we be guarding against it, or protecting it, or preparing for it, so to speak? And then finally, just to say that I've often believed diplomacy is the most important, and as you've just said, you know, diplomacy is, is almost a substitute for war. Now, in South Africa, under Durka, I believe that we've got a huge footprint, an expansive footprint, but that our actions don't always stick to the footprint. So it's all very well having a presence, but it's the relationship and it's the diplomacy. So again, you know, what has the council looked at in terms of our ambassadors, our diplomatic footprints and missions? Are, overall, would you say that we're winning that war? Or would you say that we've got a long way to go? And if we have a long way to go, where are the steps that you would advise this, this committee to start oversighting? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also thank Safwa. I'm one of the MPs who has long been calling for the establishment of this institution. I think you've got a big task ahead of you, and thank you for taking time to come and engage with us as a committee. I think we are part of the stakeholders that you will have to engage with moving forward quite regularly in order to make synergy. Because of always I had the issue, and my issue has always been this. If I call Mr. Basu at 3 a.m. in the morning and say, what is South Africa's national interest? Will he be able to tell me without blinking an eye or thinking or trying to be politically correct that this is South Africa's national interest? And I think that is the bottom line of what Safwa should come up with. As you engage in public diplomacy, make sure that we take South Africa to the bottom line, irrespective of any political party divide. I think in the history of America, this is the time where America's foreign policy is uncertain. And not only because of the shift in terms of foreign policy, but the shift because of personality, because of an individual. But not that we are confused about South Africa's foreign about America's foreign policy. It is a no. So your challenge moving forward in the 3 years that you will be piloting this project is to gather South Africans so that we can get to our bottom line, irrespective of political divide, so that we define and quantify the national interest question. Because of national interest is defined in many ways. Some are talking about poverty and employment inequality. Some are talking about 9-point plan. Some are talking about 5-point plan. So what is South Africa's national interest? What guides moving forward into this relation? So that will be your number one challenge when it comes to the public debate and your task. And the review of South Africa's foreign policy. There's been an argument to say that the honeymoon days of our foreign policy has gone in terms of our human rights-based foreign policy. Are we still in line in terms of our human rights? We've bragged recently that we've been ranked as fourth in terms of human rights. Are we still in line? Are we still following the human rights foreign policy? And I think that is where the review comes in. The world has evolved, and I think you have very much succinctly explained the global quandary that we found ourselves now, and the global politics and the geopolitics that are at play, and the role of economic diplomacy, conflict resolution in terms of security, extremism, terrorism. But are we still in line in terms of our foreign policy principles and values, in terms of human rights? I think the examples are many. Our vote patterns in the Human Rights Council leaves much to be desired. Our United Nations resolutions leaves much to be desired.
and you've spoken about one important thing, which is early warning system. And I think you need to serve as a buffer, because of sometimes South Africa react after the event, and you are forced into a corner of being a reactionary, because of then you got to be forced into a position. So we don't engage in that. The most important one, which is an advisory to the minister. Now, this is where the challenge comes. I would want to presume that you don't serve as members of SAPA as a luxury of the minister, because of then it means you are a futile exercise. Because of then your advice must be non-partisan indeed, and it must be based on not singing for your SAPA. Because of if that is the case, then you just one other entity that is there. And that would not be serving a purpose. Why I'm saying that, I would ask you, where was your advice? Did you advise the minister on the issue of the withdrawal of the ICC? Did you have any alternative? Not that I'm saying that your advice should be carried forward, but I'm just putting a hypothetical case there. Because of it's about your advisory role as part of your rules of engagement. Did you do that? The second one, linked to the issue of advice, it comes to the issue of foreign missions. We always have this debate in terms of the NDP, what the interpretation of the Chapter 7 of the NDP says in terms of punching above our weight with the number of foreign missions that we have. Some are saying I want to commercialize foreign missions. But I'm saying, in terms of your advisory role, in terms of value for money, in terms of looking at the world that is, we are evolving into, have you ever had an engagement with the ministry around the issue of foreign missions? And linked to that is the diplomatic corps, in particular, vis-a-vis the career diplomats and political diplomats. I think you have seen lately that we are found wanting in terms of the integrity of our diplomatic corps. You engage the minister in terms of it. So those are the issues that you are tackled with. I mean the issues of al-Bashir. Because if I want to find where are you in this whole space when things are happening. Because of I know that we all know that by nature foreign policy is inactive, because of the president is the custodian while the minister is the implementer of that. Just leave everybody outside. Even parliament, sometimes we are found wanting in terms of foreign policy. We react to things that have already happened. I think the withdrawal from the ICC is another classical example where parliament was just told after it has happened. Lastly is the issue of the brain drain. I would argue and say, have you also looked at the impact of natural resources? And I know that Mr. Basu is going to conflict resolution, and most of his conflict resolution revolves around the issue of mismanagement of natural resources. Now, we talk about illicit financial flows of 50 billion, but what about the money that is mismanaged that creates internal conflict within the country because of mismanagement of our natural resources? And lastly, the issue is about bringing coherency and stop flip-flopping of our foreign policy. Where are you going to be to make sure that we've got message coherence? I think it ties with the issue of the bottom line of South Africa's foreign policy. And if you look at the global trends now, you have spoken about the new liberal question. I would argue and say, let us look why is now the issue of far-right extremism, nationalistic, demagogic, fascist, and populist movement giving rise at this point in time. Because of the world is saying we've got two very strong historical moments in 2016, the Brexit and the election of Trump. And it goes around these issues. And where are we in terms of that? Let me pause there, Chairperson. We will come back for second round and the brainwave.
Thank you very much.
the next comment is from Raputi. You went out and forgiven you.
Yeah.
And will come back.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really don't know whether I say you are a professor or whatever, but it's more than one. Think tank. Thank you very much, Dr. Aziz. You know, listening of what you've been saying, and even the formation of this committee, I'm of the view that the ANC took the right decision in order that it should go and touch the world. I understand that there are plus minus 7.5 billion people in the world. I don't know whether the state has changed. And we want really to, some of the people want that we should really only think by just concentrating on just around South Africa, but really reaching out. I think that was a good strategy. That was a really Ntate Makgalapa always is against that. Why we are having such missions? We want to touch Ntate Bachman and Ntate Makgalapa. 7.5 billion. We are waiting for that. Okay. So thank you very much. And we cannot say that we are a committee of international relations and cooperation, and really concentrating on what Ntate Makgalapa wants. Ntate Makgalapa, I think you must be a visionary. Ntate and Ntate Bachman. Thank you very much.
Actually, a point of order. Is engaging me or is he engaging Sakwa?
No, and it's Sakwa.
I think we can engage each other. Yeah, that's what? No, let me make an
interview. Yeah.
Okay. I think as members comment, either at a personal level or at the level of their parties, will appear, and I'm using my words carefully, will appear to be ruffling feathers.
Mm.
Now, this will then be points of debate. Let's rather engage Sakwa. But there's nothing wrong if a person says, from my personal point of view, or from my party point of view, this is what constitutes our thinking, and what will be your advice? Because the members of SACWA come from business, from academics, from intellectuals, from former politicians, etc., to serve the ministry, to serve the country. Now, if you say this is the view you hold as a party, there's nothing wrong with that. But of course, if we want to engage as parties, we will do so. And people will preserve their right to represent the views they hold until they are advised or informed otherwise. So you can proceed, but I think, yeah, Makgalapa will write. Because then, also, if you write, you respond, and then it means this work will be able to learn with someone.
Okay.
Yeah, proceed.
Okay.
Mr.
Temo, thank you very much. And even this, Sakwa, the formation, happened that I went with the chairperson when it was launched. And I think really it's such an excellent, important kind of a structure that was formed, because it has think tankers. And it's because you said that it has 25 academics and all across. So you are international in the world. And I just wanted to touch on the issue of green trade.
You know, I'm asking how can we be able to work with other government institutions to assist in actually taking this issue of brain drain, and also on the issue of the youth part, how can you be able to assist, you know, especially on the issues of development and all those things, because now we see youth, they are gunning for what is it, economic freedom, and while they don't have any capacity, no. When they don't even have capacity, you know, you cannot cry for economy while you are brainless, and also perpetuating conflict, instability, and all those things. So how can you be able to assist a SACWA, especially in South Africa, in Africa, in the global world? And I cannot really understand that the people, like, we are having financial crisis, but we are having people who are multi-billionaires. What are you saying about these people who are really filthy rich? Filthy, filthy, filthy rich. And when we are subjected to such poverty, I think that is selfishness. That is greed to the core. Where did they get this kind of money? We want to be assisted. And on the issues of extremism, on the issues of terrorism, you know, I think those are the issues that really are having in us. And we can see, you know, people will come with certain kind of things, but I think somewhere, somehow, the importance of the media, somewhere that's exacerbating this kind of war, uncertainties of kind of terror and extremism. So where is the media, whereby it could be able to assist on the issues of development? But thank you for your for the work that you are doing. Yesterday the WIB was saying that you are when I was talking to the WIB, then we are going to have this meeting, and we said that SACO is coming, and he said that no, the conductor of the choir will be coming. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hatel.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I would like to welcome the formation of SACWIA and then congratulate all the members who were appointed into that. We know that the work, the terrain we're entering is very fluid and very unstable. So a lot of expectations are going to be raised against you. But you must know that you must focus so that you are going to serve the Republic of South Africa. But first of all, Chair, I really like the way the Chairperson has gone to town in raising a lot of issues concerning the issue of SACWIA. But the first thing which I want us to deal with, I think what Honorable Mkalapa has said, how do we make the South African foreign policy to be understood by the ordinary man in the street? What is SACWIA going to do to
kill a woman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the women are advanced. The women are advanced. They know. They're already there. So that's why the men of the street will stay here. So how are we going to reach all these people so that at the end of the day, we are able to defend the South African foreign policy in all the multilateral fora in which we participate? That would be my first taking. Number two, Chen, will be the issue of, I think the chairperson was minimal
on the issue of transformation of global institutions. Because we like it or not, the United Nations Security Council was formed somewhere in 1945 when the UN was formed. And the world has changed drastically. Unless we change the UN, the Security Council itself and the UN, we are not going to achieve what we want to achieve. In bringing peace to the world, in bringing economic equity to the world. So what is it which SACWA is going to do to ensure that we sustain that? I can make an example out of that. As Honorable Mkhalapa said that we have to rationalize the mission. But the issue here, I'm from the African National Congress. I'll say that in order for you to influence the world, you must be all over the world so that you are in touch with the people. So I'll expect a view of SACWA around that. Because which country in the world? I can make an example like America. America is even the smallest country in the whole world. They're everywhere. That's why they're able to influence the world event. So we, as South Africa, are we expected to be a colonial people there in the corner so that they depend upon the other countries when we come to the issue of exercise of power? Number two, Chen, on the issue of the ICC, I want to allude to that. First of all, I'd like to appreciate the Constitutional Court of the Republic of South Africa, which confirmed that the state, the government, has the right to determine the foreign policy of the country. I think that confirmation has put this into bed, that the foreign policy of the Republic is determined by the government of South Africa. So I really appreciate that one. But on the issue of the ICC, we could see that it is not treating all the people equal. Not treating all the people. How will you bring the attention or to the ordinary people again on the street? Why the position which the government has taken around that? And then on the issue of extremism and terrorism, again, let's go to the source of that. Middle East was very stable before, until Saddam Hussein was taken out. And then we know that he was taken out on false pretenses. That one is a fact. And then after being taken out on false pretenses, the whole world is suffering as we're speaking now. We've got this extremism which is everywhere. As Mandela, the former president, warned them that what is different between us and the Middle East people is that they've got this religious government. So once we put a person's religion into the bay, that person will never listen to reason. We've got that. Also, you go to Libya. It's a similar thing to go for the regime change. I didn't see you going to town on the policy of regime change, which has brought all the trouble in the world. It is that today. We go back to the former Congo when the regime change was done on Patrice Lumumba. We know even up to this day, 1960, even up to this day, Congo is unstable. It is still unstable even up to this day, although the coup took place long time ago. So what is it? What is it which SACWA will bring to the table so that we alert the people, the ordinary masses of the people on the ground, that the policies of regime change are dangerous policies. They're dangerous policies because when the people have chosen a government, those people's choice must be respected. I think that one must go straight to the ground on this. On the issue of the illicit financial outflows, it's true, Chair, that if you take $50 billion, which is getting illegal out of Africa, that money could have been used to develop the human resource of the continent. What is it which the SACWA is going to do to marshal the forces even within the country and within the country so that we black this thing out. I'll come back in for the second question. Thank you.
Hello,
Sophie.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah.
Just want also to congratulate the members of the council, and I wish them all the best. When I look at the list, Chair of the council, Compact Assist. Yeah. I want you to look at me. Now, when I look at the list, I saw Sisomandla Zondi and Sisomandla Bafikeng, and they're not here. Yeah, so you must also just communicate with them to say, hey, we are very disappointed in this committee. Because, in fact, we're looking forward to meet all of you guys. Because I think we are. How long have you been into the office?
Just a year.
Yeah, we are still crawling. So it would be very good to just to meet all of you. The second question, Chair, that I want to pose is that I just want to understand if the council is full time or not, because I believe they have a lot on their plate. Advising international relations on international relations matters is not a chat play. And when I see in your presentation, we'll just would like to get more of the details one. Because when I look at your objectives, as Honorable Khatebe was saying, each and every person, even a lay person on the street, must understand what is your role, must understand the foreign policy, what it's all about. It must not be here in this committee and the members of parliament and those people who are in government. Also, the ordinary member, we must understand. But when I see this presentation, especially on the objective of Sakawa, I think we're in the right direction. And we'll like to see more of this happening on public debates, consultative forum, and so on and so on. We are looking forward to that one. So I just want to say all the best to you guys, and you must make us proud.
No, you're saying that for the second time. In a formal meeting, guys is not used.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to have you again as this committee. And when I enter in this meeting, Chair, the secretary informed me to say that you want to meet all political parties, all political caucuses, of which I think is also well and good. So I'll communicate with that to the EFF caucuses, and I'll make sure that you come and brief the caucuses. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, I also want to introduce, I would like Honorable Mwango to introduce himself. Honorable Mwango.
Wednesday is not a good day for me, because I am all my meetings in different venues. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mwango. Yes. Honorable Kenya, you are on the floor. No, he was introducing himself, not me. One of Kenya is on the floor. Kenya?
I didn't check what was wrong with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for the information you got. Also, to meet you for the first time. I wish the minister should have appointed you for the first year term, so that really you do this job, not rushing this job, because this is a really, very important stakeholder. I think my very serious question has been asked by Comrade Beggy when I was thinking about the illegal flow of capital. I'm not going to get to it, because I just also wanted to know how can we deal with this problem in Africa. Also, as an advisory and consultative forum, have you got a plan to meet the entire 3 spheres of government? Because if we say you want to popularize the foreign policy, therefore there is a need for touching all these your local government, provincial government, and also that to check how do you bring society to foreign processes. Again, you talked. Mr. Pad, on the loss of 20,000 professionals a year in the continent. And that, I think, to my understanding, that is a threat. I don't understand what, I don't know maybe what remedy can be used, as you are also advisors and can use, as you predict that in 25 years, our continent will be in danger. What do you think, what can we do, therefore? What is your program on the issue? Also, because it has been appointed as minister for a period of 3 years, and then I think we also have an obligation also to invite you to participate, as Honorable Shubesa said, in our outreach programs, to popularize also the South African policy, foreign policy. have you got a standard plan for communicating with us during our outreach programs? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I would rather we all comment from this side and then we will not come back. Babu Mpumlwane and Babu Mwango and myself. Or otherwise, we will not comment on our position at Tunugan and then you come back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, time permitting, we can do that. We can do that. I'm just checking whether we find anything.
No, personally, I just want to congratulate and hope that we'll be able to have an interest that the country is out. And I want to say the problem we're having in this committee, which I think you might hear, is that we don't seem to be having one opinion as to what is the interest of the country at heart. So perhaps you may have one opinion or you may discuss that. This gives a problem because if you go to other countries, take America, they may fight inside the country. But about foreign policy, they don't differ. Here we differ a lot. Maybe we are still a growing country. We still start trying to become a country that is united and forward. Maybe you will assist us in that. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Another one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greetings to you. I do want also to align myself with those who actually congratulate the SACWA and also wish them well in their endeavors. And I think that they will actually go a long way in helping not only the minister but also this committee in formulating sound policy. Foreign policy, position. Because as it is right now, there's a great deal of concern and sometimes contradiction on our policy positions. For instance, the issue of the Palestine question. There's a serious policy dichotomy in that regard because on one hand, the governing party actually is seen hitting the streets toying in support of Palestine, and the government, the minister actually stands up and says the government actually embraces the two-state solution. So then you begin to ask, where do you draw the line between the governing party position and the government, given the fact that actually the minister is supposed to be representing the party position. So that confuses South Africans, I must say. And also the issue of serious problems of our budgetary constraints. How do we actually align our foreign policy ambitions to match our budgetary constraints? Because I personally and the party I represent actually feel that foreign missions that we currently have are too much and are too many, and we cannot afford them because we have other budgetary priorities. The country is coming out of a serious situation just under 30 years ago, and we still have a lot of competing priorities that we need to look at. So I heard one of my colleagues saying that South Africa should actually be represented all over. Fine. But we need to match our ambitions with our budgetary situation. America can afford to do that, can they? That's another question. And also our aspirations of being wanting to be a continental police, as it were. Can we actually match that with our budgetary realities? We want to be all over Africa. Is our effort actually welcome by our African counterparts out there? Are we not actually being viewed with some suspicions of wanting to overload their own situations? You know, one tends to pick up the kind of vibe when we visit out there that South Africa wants to play a big brother, which I don't think is very healthy for us. Issues like, you could actually advise us even on the issue of that the advisability of us pulling out of their own statute, because that is also confusing. Because on one hand, we want to position ourselves as the champion of the rule of law and the human rights, but at the same time, we want to shun away from, you know, structures that actually seek to enforce those values. So I would like to actually end there for now, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mwango. Now, I'm the only one who hasn't said anything. Where do we start? Yeah, just a few comments and questions. The chair says that Sequoia is 25 members. Yeah, I wanted to start there. I think in the composition seems to be good in terms of formations that it reflects, but I suspect that it does not have a sufficient network in terms of the information it must gather and the influence it must make. I know in terms of references to our Vice Minister, therefore President and Government. I'm not sure if I should make a recommendation, but I wish it had some focal persons drawn from very strategic sectors within provinces. And the reason being that you have many business people, councillors, provincial government, MPLs, who also visit other countries, who also have MOUs and other things with MOUs and what is called MOU, bilateral, etc., with certain provinces in other countries. When I was in Mpumalanga, we had MOUs with North Rhine-Westphalia, but once you are in that country, they ask you about Zimbabwe, and they ask you things about the Africa region, not even South Africa. They said, you know, in the Africa region, what about this, what about that? And my sense is, I'll come back to that. I was just saying that network is actually very, very important. And while I was on this, I think not all South Africans are fully appreciative of what actually should constitute the national interest of a country, or rather of a sovereign state, and whether national interest is actually limited to the party or is actually extending beyond the party to the state, and that it will be an ever-changing
national interest. Because from time to time, you interact with an environment that will change. And therefore, national interest, while it may remain with its core values, but it will take into account or must take into account new dynamics that have evolved. And I said I'll come back to this because when I was talking about the provincial network, I suspect, and I'm saying this with utmost respect, that there is a fair amount of clout among very influential people in our society. And we're not the only ones, I don't imagine. MPs, business leaders, and citizens. And something must be done about it. Whilst you advise government, perhaps we must find a way to communicate national interest through government and through parliament to the people, and perhaps through civil society, so that when we engage the world, we know what is in it for us as a people or as a nation. For me, that is very important. And I think because we don't have dedicated universities in this area of work, hence I'm talking about some fair level of doubt about this, particularly also in the provinces as well. And then, I'm not sure if we should get into that because we were not discussing American elections. But because we have indeed spoken about the media, the influence the media makes, etc., etc., and your observation that sometimes the media misses the point. To influence the direction in which elections must go in the country. In the USA, for instance, Trump was regarded as an outsider, outside the police establishment of that country, and of course Hillary represents corporate influence, political, and she has been there for a long time, and the media. You see, we may need to find time and space to look at this balance, the outsideness and the insideness of persons who are there in their own society, who, against the media predictions, get elected, such as what has happened with President-elect Trump. Because it could be that the media actually misses the point of capturing the real issues that guide the majority of the people in a country. And America is not alone. Zimbabwe, this is what has been happening. Media in the USA, media in South Africa, they say this is what will happen, that people vote otherwise. And then they live with denial. It has also happened in many other countries. If you look at what the world was saying about Putin, and less than 2 months ago I was in that country, he got even more majority this time. Because he is seen to be very ruthless in safeguarding national interest, in the same way that conservative Americans think that Trump will do in a world that is a bit becoming uncertain. So I'm just saying media sometimes, you are correct, that it does not always reflect what is happening. Now, there is something I wanted to check with you. And it is that right-wing collectives and conservatism and narrow nationalism, as Bachmann was saying earlier on, sometimes emerges during times of strife, poverty, all of these things. If you remember the Great Depression of 1929, the right-wing parties that emerged there. Here in South Africa, it was the Osama bin Laden that produced the UPG, most of others, Mussolini, Hitler. In the USA, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, no, FD Roosevelt. Now, I'm not sure if I would be right to say that the financial crisis of 2008 has an influence in the attitude and the conduct of foreign policy that you see now in China, in Russia, the Brexit itself, and the USA, because people want to safeguard that which is their own, because they think they are scarce resources. And again, so I was trying to compare 1929 and 2008, but I also want to compare the League of Nations and the United Nations. You would remember that in the 1930s up to the outbreak of the Second World War, 1939, many influential and strong leaders and states actually acted outside the League of Nations. They actually called it contemptuous, to use the words of Mussolini. Now, but Hitler and Mussolini actually were front players in undermining the League of Nations up to the outbreak of the Second World War, acting outside it, very militaristic, all of the things that the words that you have used. Now, I personally see and have been seeing the same phenomenon about certain states acting outside the United Nations organization to pursue national interests in a very militaristic way, in a very aggressive way, etc., etc. Where is the place of the stature of the UNO as a multilateral forum in the scheme of things to influence the world? Is it also held in contempt like the League of Nations? And what could be the implications of that? And perhaps the last issues, I just want to make the point that other issues like the ICC and others, you are free to say what you can say to them. But obviously we who come from the ANC hold a totally different view. I can speak to that now, but I don't think it is for now necessary. But I would say that we from the ANC in the committee are in full support of the decision of Minister of Justice, the Minister of Foreign International Relations and Cooperation, because they are guided by the decision of the National General Council. But South Africa itself is guided by the decision of the AU. It was a collective decision that all the state parties, all the member states, were or resolved that they would ignore or whatever provisions are there in the Rome Statute when one of their members, including Al-Bashir, visits until their issues are attended to by the ICC. And again, it became a decision of the state parties within the AU to collectively withdraw. So, and of course, South Africa being a wealthy and dependable member of the AU, it wouldn't say it will act otherwise. Of
course, there are states that countries that will act otherwise. I know Botswana has already said it will not. So we hold different views. But what will also be important again, because we hold different views, and the reasons for which we hold it, for instance, to say it means South Africa is no longer holding in high esteem human rights, and our human rights depend on the ICC, and our human rights have not all evolved within our own struggle. That kind of misrepresentation. If you look at what is enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948 by the UN, and many other conventions, and if you look at the age of the ANC and other progressive parties, to make this claim is a serious point of debate. But we can't put you into that. It is important we, the different parties, engage the South Africans on this matter. Get the country talking. Yeah. Thank you very much. Over to you now.
Very fascinating questions, and we need a two-day workshop. But I think we've got very, in our team, we've got people representing various aspects. I think, otherwise you're going to complain with God when I just, they heard me again. So let's give them a chance to answer. And
all the difficult questions and then answer them.
Yeah, please, colleagues, you're many and three haven't turned up, but please, this is only opportunity. This is an opportunity that we can interact with policy makers.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. For this wonderful opportunity that you've presented to us as members of the South African Council on International Relations. I must say that it is indeed a pleasure for some of us to interact with policymakers, because I think it is imperative that we do that at some point. There were some various questions that were proposed from the floor, but I think the one that drew my interest was the one on of how do we make South African foreign policy understood by ordinary people. Well, the thing is, it's a very critical, question that was raised. And I think, as SACWA, we go further to say, how can we make ordinary people own? Because the thing is about ownership, Chapter 6, the ownership of the foreign policy by ordinary people. So the question is therefore, how can we assist in the process? Now, I happen to come from the NGO sector, civil society, so to speak, and I represent a very big, largest umbrella board of NGOs in the country, Sangoko. I'm the current national president of Sangoko. And it's an outcry which has been raised by ordinary NGOs, that we see a situation prevailing in our country today where we are effectively marginalized from making concrete inputs in the trajectory of our country. A serious concern. And to the extent that this view, it has strained the relationship between the government and the broader society. It's a serious concern. And I think As SACWA members, we have to assist, we will endeavor to assist in the development of a clear framework and strategy of engagement. Because it is something that we have to own up to that initiative, Chair. So that ordinary peoples and their organs of people's power, because in the past we used to call them organs of people's power. It is those people that in the past we used to engage them. And I think the call to SACWA is to rekindle that memory. Not only us, but policymakers as well. So that all of us, you know, we can critically engage ordinary people. Because I think with this in mind, it will fix the relationship between government and ordinary citizens. Review to hold roundtables. Review to develop something that we think can help in this regard. Because it is important that people of this country they own up to this process. We've seen in the past various policies being passed without proper engagement of the sector of ordinary people. We've seen in the past processes, you know, being where we're called in to just only to rubber stamp without giving due consideration for ordinary people to engage. And I think the time has come for us to work on that. And I think the SACWA member will endeavor to assist the policymakers. And I think we are appealing to also the policymakers to work with us on this journey to ensure that, you know, people, was already there's anger out there. You see what is happening daily in our township, in our area. People are angry. Their voice is not being heard. And we need to ensure that, you know, we assist that process. So we'll endeavor to assist them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Further taker? Madam?
Thank you, Chair. I would like to thank you, Chair, and also the committee for hosting us today. It's something that the council has been looking forward to for quite a long time. And I do hope we can get something going. I like the idea of a day or a two-day workshop very much, because I think what is really required is something that Vasu mentioned this morning, is for us to generate ideas, we run the risk of increasingly formulating policies without any ideas, anything long-term in terms of what we are striving for. And I think this could make for a very useful way of engaging. I want to just apologize on behalf of my colleague, Sipamandla Zondi. You mentioned that he's going to present a big public lecture tomorrow evening at the university, and I'm afraid he has to prepare for that. He would have liked to be here. I want to make comments on three specific issues. The one is on this idea of the national interest. And forgive me if I speak as an academic, we're not very practical. But I think we have an important role to play in society. We're supposed to sit and be impractical and think a little bit and talk about it, and then the practitioners can take it up and start to imagine how would a policy look based on that. So first of all, on the national interest, I've been doing a bit of studying on this over the past 2 months. I'm on a fellowship at the moment, so I've got a bit of time. And the one thing that strikes me, I'm looking specifically at South Africa's external or so-called state identity. And the one thing that strikes me from the literature is a saying, and this is, we cannot know what we want if we do not know who we are. And I do think we need to keep that in mind. And that's why national interest tends to change over time as we have debates within the country about who we are. The way in which we look at ourselves and what we want internationally will also change. And I think, colleagues, we all know that this is turning into a huge debate inside the country now. Who are we? I mean, we are really challenging that idea, and it's very uncomfortable for many of us, perhaps especially for people like me, very uncomfortable, this idea of challenging the Rainbow Nation concept. But it's an important debate that is going on, and it does have an impact for our national interest, because it tells us where do we have to focus in terms of inside the country to look at what it is that we need outside. So I think we must expect a period of uncertainty around our national interest. The second point that I want to make is that this rise of nationalism, several people have referred to it. I don't think it's necessarily only a right-wing kind of development. It's not only a turn to the right. I think it's much more a case of a turn to the people and ordinary people being completely disillusioned with their governments. And to some extent, the debates inside our country are about the same things, feeling removed from political power, feeling that they're not heard. I heard my colleague now from civil society expressing the same kind of sentiment. And this is what gives rise. We see it as the rise of the right outside of the country. It's not necessarily right-wing. We are ourselves part of this. And I think government needs to pay a lot of attention to this idea of people becoming disillusioned with those who govern them. And we need to think about how we're going to address that. My third point, and that will be the last one, is on the idea of brain drain. I think this is one place where we can really try and take hands and work together. The one thing that has struck me over many years of being an academic is the extent to which we lose our own students when they go overseas. When you, or when the government, or DIRCO, concludes bilateral agreements or other agreements with foreign countries, these very often entail scholarships for our students to go outside and study. Very often they're our top students because they get these scholarships on the basis of merit. Very often they don't return to the country. So to some extent, we are using our resources to train the brains for the rest of the world. And one way in which we can deal with this is to look very carefully at our bilateral agreements and to try and push for more money for students to stay inside the country and to do their studies here. And a way in which we can do it is through this idea of joint degrees. So in other words, a student can have a co-supervisor at a very good university internationally, but in the end, they stay here, and the degree comes from two universities, and everyone is very happy. The second aspect around this brain drain thing, if we look at the rest of the continent, colleagues, our students who come from the rest of Africa who find it incredibly difficult to get their study permits to study here in this country. If you look at the NDP, it makes mention of the fact that it's part of what we want to do is to build the intellectual capacity of the rest of the continent as well, yet we make it almost impossible for these students to come here. And I think that is something where we really need to, I know it's not necessarily in this portfolio committee, but you can exercise influence on some of the other committees, we need to look at the visa system and how we get those students here. We need to encourage our so-called foreign donors to give more money to our South African universities to assist us in providing spaces for the brightest people on the continent to come here and to ensure that they go back to their own countries. And thirdly, I think that the members of this committee can make a big contribution as practitioners by trying to engage with our universities, to come and talk to our students about our foreign policy from the different political parties, but draw our students in, make our youth, we all talk about the youth bulge, what are we going to do? But if we don't engage with them, we are not going to make them believe that there is a future for them. And I think that if you talk about how do we make our foreign policy more understandable to ordinary people, then we need to talk to the youth. One way of doing that is through working through our universities. Many of us would welcome this with open arms, because it is difficult for us to give our students that kind of access. Our students need to talk to the practitioners. They need to hear people who've got long histories or very practical experience. They can't just study from books. And we're going through a revolution within our tertiary institutions. I don't have to tell you that. Our students want to know, what is it that we teach them? Well, when we teach them, we need the support of the practitioners as well. It's not just a case of us walking in and giving them a few books. This thing around decolonizing and Africanizing our universities will mean a completely different relationship between practitioners, academics, and students. And that is something that we can also start here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further takers? Dr. Vasu Gounde.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by assuring the Portfolio Committee that SACWA is an independent body. Although appointed by the Minister, we don't serve at the behest of the Minister. We are paid for attendance at meetings, but we are all gainfully employed and sufficiently independent to exercise without fear or favor, so you can rest assured that we will do that and do it critically. The second point to make, I've listened very carefully at all of the questions that were asked by the different members, and we're not very far off from each other in terms of the issues. But I think what seems to be a lot of the problem is we don't seem to communicate a lot and persuade each other of the positions. And maybe there should be a lot more debate. Now we have, in essence, three forums. The Portfolio Committee, which is a multi-party forum, which is probably the most important, because we have to make sure that, particularly on foreign policy, we speak with one voice as a nation, not as different political parties, and we can only do that if we are persuaded about the different positions. And I'll touch on one or two of them to see how important it is. If we are able to sit down and persuade each other, we might be able to at least appreciate where people come from on those positions. The second is the department is here. The department formulates and articulates those policies, and the department has a responsibility in formulating and articulating to consult where possible, because not always possible, as widely as possible with the different constituencies. It can't go to the general public, but the Portfolio Committee and now SACWA, which is more broadly representative of society, can be consulted on a number of decisions. So I think, for example, the ICC decision, it could have been more broadly consulted. maybe there would have been a better appreciation of it by everybody, so that when it was articulated, it would have got broadly more support from everybody. So just some of those things. So I think a matter of communication, consultation, how we take those decisions might become more important and how we can improve them. Why we should be doing that, Chair, is because I think what our chairperson, Mr. Pard, has articulated is increasingly a very dangerous world, one that is extremely fragile, and a world in which we are an extremely fragile player also. Our situation is not a good one in South Africa. We can debate about why we are where we are, but the fact is we are where we are. And where we are is that we have very serious problems. We have not dealt completely with the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. These are facts that come out of Stats South Africa. They are indications there. In addition, as I've articulated to this portfolio committee previously, and which Mr. Fahad touched on, the five other issues that are converging rapidly, and at the same time, the exponential population growth, which outstrips our economic growth. And when your economic growth is lower than your population growth, you've got a serious problem. The second is rapid urbanization, which is a good thing if you're creating a second economy. We aren't. So, and that's the same with large parts of the continent. There's no shift from an agrarian economy to an industrial and information economy. So low-skilled farm workers who are moving to the center are not absorbed into new economies. And in our case, we have a huge skills deficit. So even if we are creating, we aren't able to absorb. The third is climate change. And, you know, we're in a five-year drought spell. I've just come back from Malawi, which is a wasteland. 6.5 million people starving in Malawi of a population of 16 million. It's a dire situation. You know, you fly over and you can just see brown. You drive through and you can see people on the streets. It's not a nice situation. And I had meetings there with the advisors to the president. We sat down with members of different communities and discussed the situation and the problems that they're having and how critical that situation is. Then, Chair, you've got a global economic slowdown, which is tanking all our economies. And then you've got a commodity crisis, and we are largely single commodity economies. In South Africa, we rely, although we're a diversified economy, we rely heavily on commodities also. It's not a major part of our economy, but it's an important part of our economy. So if you put all of those factors together, we then have very serious problems inside the country. But then let's just extend it to the SADC region. In the SADC region, we are fast approaching levels of instability that are going to be unmanageable. We've got problems in Mozambique between Frelimo and Renamo. And you've got a fragile situation within Mozambique's economy itself. We know what the DRC, we know that we are not going anywhere. Its population is increasing at a rapid rate, unmanageable rate. We've got an election coming up. We've got serious problems. We've got a very fragile situation in Zimbabwe, and that problem in Zimbabwe could explode any day. We know what's happening in Lesotho. As I said, Malawi, there's a problem. So let's not even go to the rest of the continent where there are very serious problems, just in our own neighborhood. And we are a pull factor. Now, I sat on the commission last year investigating violence against foreigners in KwaZulu-Natal. And largely, we cannot afford more refugees in the country. We just can't. Our social system, our economy, our own problems can't allow that situation. But if the situation in the other countries explodes, as in the rest of the SADC region, then we will see an influx of refugees into South Africa. So these are not problems that are going to hit us 5 years from now. These are problems that are months away, if they happen. So then, if we look then, Chair, at Now we go outside and say, what then about our foreign relations? And why we need to have consensus, why we need to engage. I've just come back from six European capitals in the last 2 months, where I've engaged with all the Africa departments to explain our own dire situation in Africa and in South Africa, and why the paradigm that we sit in is very different from where they sit. And they cannot look at us through their eyes and understand our problems. They have to see from where we are. I've also just visited about 8 African capitals where we've engaged with governments, intergovernmental agencies, etc., to alert them to these same problems that we are having. The fact that we haven't transitioned from agrarian economies, we haven't dealt with the triple challenges, we've got these 5 factors converging, and many of the countries north of us are at a serious tipping point, very serious tipping point. They've got huge swathes of people that have moved to the urban centers to absolutely nothing. No employment, no housing, no sanitation. It's a conflict belt that is sitting in the center. So that's the tipping point. The second is they're in a race against time, because their populations are exploding, their economies are tanking, and the problem gets exponentially worse and worse. So here we are as a country. Now we have to think about our foreign relations and how we act throughout the continent. Can we be the policemen of the continent? No, we cannot. Because we just don't have the wherewithal to do it. But at the same time, we cannot disengage from the continent. So what do we do if we don't disengage? Militarily, we have certain constraints. We were very effective in Eastern Congo in helping to deal with the situation there on an offensive engagement. And we are going to be called on as South Africa to participate in peace enforcement increasingly around the continent. It's not something that we're going to be able to sustain. So we have to then also sharpen our skills of diplomacy and how we engage our diplomats to go in and assist with peacemaking and other things so that we can mitigate these situations without having then to deploy our military also, because of the limitations, both financial constraints as well as operational constraints that we have on that. So then let me just end by taking 2 issues. Let's just take the ICC issue, because it's a very controversial issue. There are many dimensions to the issue. The first dimension is one about consistency in the global system. You know, I trained as a human rights lawyer in the U.S. at Georgetown University. And I used to always, my human rights lawyer was a Father Drinan, Professor Drinan. And every time he invoked one of the international protocols, I would put my hand up and say, Professor, before you go on, has your country signed up? And he would say, Mr. Groundon, I'm embarrassed to say that my country has not signed up. But can we continue with the lecture? The point is that there is a debate around how do we build a normative world, a new world, without the major powers signing up to this. And what then is the responsibility of smaller nations? We dismantled our nuclear capability, and that was it. Nobody else dismantled their nuclear capability. I agree with that decision that we dismantled it. I agree with the fact that we were the first to sign up to the Rome Statutes, that we were one of the founding members in order to set the basis for a new world, one based on the rule of law, one based on dealing with impunity. But we expected that the others would come on board also. They did not come on board, and then we have the situation where we have to also preserve African unity. And the situation on the continent became extremely controversial with the decisions that were taken. Now, I saw the Deputy President's statement about us playing a role in mediating on the continent, and I discussed this with my friends, and they said it's an excuse that he gave for why we pulled out of the ICC. The reality of the matter is we are engaged, I've been engaged for a long time in Burundi. And we're in the middle of a delicate situation in Burundi that could swing one way or the other, and we could be back in the situation of genocide. Now, when they said that they will take the president of Burundi to the ICC, I can tell you that the situation is not that easy. A lot of what generated that particular decision was a media frenzy in a capital. The situation, and we can, you know, I'm very happy to come back and address the portfolio committee in detail on the situation in Burundi. So that is a better, and this is where I say it's communication. You know, if we came, took you through the trajectory of the conflict, the complicated factors of the conflict, what is happening in the conflict, etc., there'd be a better appreciation for why we think that maybe the ICC was premature in making that announcement about Burundi. So it's all these issues, I think, that, you know, come to the fore. And primary to all of this, I was in New York now, where I had lunch with our permanent representative, former director general. We had a long discussion. And South Africa had a candidate in the International Law Commission, which was successful. But we did not get the votes that we usually get, in the numbers that we usually get. Which means that there are people looking at us and saying, no, but South Africa, you are compromising your stand that you took on human rights, etc. So this is the reality. And this is something that we have to now persuade the rest of the world, that we are not consistent in how we stand to uphold the norms and standards that we have preached from 1994, and explain to them why we want to take certain decisions. But we can't if we don't communicate amongst ourselves first and persuade amongst ourselves. So I would like to just appeal, you know, on this score, and to reiterate again that yes, as SACWA, I know the members of SACWA, we are going to exercise our minds without fear or favor, critically. We want to engage with you as all of the parties want to engage with the department and make sure that in the end, we are doing this in the interest of South Africa, in preserving a democracy, in preserving a human rights culture, and in ensuring that we deal with the triple challenges, all of which are currently under threat by ourselves and then by the situation outside. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any further takers?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. As you can imagine, how difficult it is to speak after Mr. Kunden. I'll attempt, but I think, Chair, it's also important. There are other issues that have been raised, and let me thank the members of the portfolio committee. The extent to which, as you listen, issues of international relations are being engaged with, and I think it's a good thing. Particularly coming from a platform which is represented by different political parties, I think it is quite encouraging. And I think just to pick up on some of the issues that have been raised, Vasu is correct. I mean, when you listen to the issues that are raised, we're not far in terms of our thinking. So far as issues of the national interest is concerned, in fact, I can confirm that in the three meetings of the council, we always have this discussion. What is it that we've got to do? And I think there's an appreciation that that matter must be discussed and that matter must be fully analyzed so that we're able to correctly address the issue. And of course, the reason why I suppose Prof. Schoeman is engaging on the literature around this question is because we've engaged it. And as well, personally, I've done the same. And it became very clear to me that before we could talk about the interest, we must also address the issue of the national question and begin to say who defines the understanding of what South Africa's national question is. Because it goes to the issue that Prof is raising, to say who are you to have an interest. So if you don't understand who you are, it becomes difficult to have an interest and a unified position so far as what South Africa's interest is. And I think this is a discussion that, fortunately enough, we're still fairly new in our portfolio, in our responsibility. And it comes at a time where all of us are really interacting and are grappling with the geopolitics of the world. And I think the timing is quite impeccable for us to can be able to engage on this matter. It's a very important issue, in fact, that we've been engaging ourselves. Let me further say that it is equally important to take what is coming out of what the members are saying, but I think we need to do something about it. I mean, there's a powerful thinking about the issues that we're touching on issues of brain drain, illicit financial outflows, and so forth. And somebody saying, is that not perpetuated by the fact that there's mismanagement of natural resources? I think it's a very powerful question that we must be able to engage with and be able to provide context. Because if we're then able to do that, maybe the very same professionals could, in fact, if we're able to properly manage our resources, then there's no reason why we are losing professionals. I think it's a powerful. So these are issues that we need to begin to engage. One of the things that one has come across since being appointed in the council is that you are expected to have answers for everything, which is not the case. And I think it's always fair to come out clear that, in fact, ourselves, our responsibility really is to bring to the table our experiences insofar as our interaction with South Africans and the world community. And as such, we'll be able to continue to discuss and engage to ensure that whatever is that we eventually agree as a country is a unified position. Che, needless to also say that I think the issues of how young people view the world and what is it that we do as a country to give hope to young people that we continue to be relevant in the world, it's something that we also need to prove. The challenges that we see and the realities of the extent to which young people have become very agile in terms of the energy to change things cannot be taken for granted. And they cannot be minimized by views that says no, there's disrespect and so forth. I think we need to provide some further analysis. Because indeed, young people through the social media, as you said, today they've got exposure on what is happening in other countries and how other young people are taken serious insofar as being able to influence policy, being able to implement policy, and so forth. And therefore, for us, it cannot be seen as if it's something alien to the reality. We're part of the global world and we should be able to realize that as such. So I think the a lot of issues that have been raised. My personal view is that cannot be concluded in this meeting. In fact, I thought this was the first meeting to introduce Akwa and but I think the issues that are coming out, they then are able to enable one to go back and begin to further engage with the issues. Check. I think platforms of engagement have been opened, and we certainly appreciate that, and we hope that whatever is that we are bringing to the table will necessarily advance the cause of South Africa's foreign policy and South Africa's role in the space of diplomacy. And in closing, Chair, I must indicate that we cannot downplay the role that South Africa is playing and continues to play in the continent, and how important it is that as a region of the world we are able to consolidate effort. Now, we can choose to be an island in the world or in the continent, or we can choose to continue to play the role that we have been playing, being realistic to our own challenges in the country. I think that's something that we need to be able to appreciate. However, we've already at a point where, whether we like it or we don't, at a point where we cannot retreat from what we have been able to do. Which means that at the point at which we are expected naturally to continue with the efforts that we've shown. How we deal with our realities in the country should also be take cognizant of already what we are doing. And those are some of the issues that I think we need to grapple with, and I think we need to debate and come up with fair resolutions on how do we deal with these matters. They cannot be emotional, I think. They should be based on fact and proper analysis, so that when we take a decision, as Vas was saying, I think it should be a culture that it is an informed decision that is consulted upon. And I think with those few words, Chair, let me close and say one would appreciate to, you know, probably request through the Chair, of course, that we have some form of a standing agenda, you know, and an activity plan. Because then that will then assist us to be able to know what is it that we've got to engage with. And that plan will then be able to assist members as well to prepare themselves properly to come and engage with these issues, because I think they are very important. Chair, let me close it at that point. Thanks very much.
Yes, in fact, there are a few things that I have packaged. I was just going to wonder whether I should not speak to them, so that DERCO, as a secretariat, can also look at them and see how they can be processed. And because the first one, not the first in order of importance, was that we must have a particular regularity of meetings. Yes, I have not consulted with the members of the committee. But if it could be possible that every 6 months, in other words, the first semester and the second semester, we have a consultation with Sakwai. We have discussions looking at what has happened 6 months ago and what is likely to happen in the next 6 months. It will be good for committee members. Well, 6 months, I'm not married to that. Because from time to time when we debate or we even ask questions to the minister, to the president and everyone else, we need to be better informed about this. The second one is what Honorable Shop was talking about addressing parliamentary party caucuses. I'm in full support of that. Now, I don't know whether you would want to be invited, but there are certain parties in parliament, and some parties are made up of two or three people. Now, the department or yourselves could check whether you are going to group parties like that. The ANC alone has 249, the EFF has 25, so you can take them as a group.
EFF. The DA has 89 Mukhalapa, so they can be spoken to as one caucus. And I don't want to speak for other parties, but you just to save time, you can find a way to us. You'll be saying one and the same thing. And in those engagements, you'll have a better appreciation of who thinks what, and because they are at a party level that we, and they'll be telling you as a non-partisan structure. So now you will have to advise us whether you want to be invited by the chief whip of that party, whatever will happen. But I'm very much in support of that. The third one is on the foreign, perhaps let me put it this way. There is a foreign service bill before us, and we were, circumstances just conspired against what we wanted to do. We were supposed to have gone by now, or next month, early next month, but by now we should have been able to go to Algeria, to Canada, and to the United Nations. And by the time we applied, which was the second time the chair of committee said, looking at the program of not allowing you, please do it at some other time. And then we've since reapplied for January. The point, however, is that the Foreign Service Bill, which has been brought to Parliament by Cabinet, wants to harmonize policy for the various actors, your trade attachés, your home affairs, your DTI, our international relations, and others. Now, and we have thought that we need to consult with other countries on how they have evolved their own policies. Canada will be one of them, Algeria will be one of them. But South Africa and the ANC, particularly the ANC as a ruling party, has over years belonged to the non-aligned movement. Speaking for myself, not the committee, it would be important to consult countries in the West and countries in the East to inform our own as to how, when they built their foreign policy legislation, they factored in different stakeholders, something like that. The fourth one, is a bit extraneous. In that it talks about the brain drain. But I had a privilege, just to throw it, I had a privilege in 1998 of attending the first conference of the African Renaissance, as a result of which at some point you had the African Institute. It was agreed that to mitigate this, because it's a challenge for the whole continent and a challenge for the world. when I was at university, just as an example, you had a very lucrative American scholarship, a Fulbright scholarship, which would be given to students who have passed in distinction to go and study in the USA. And if they do well there, like any other country, they can be given citizenship, they can get married there, they are given jobs. So the powerful, actually, can source out the best brains of the world, and they don't say this brain is black, is Asian, is Jewish. They just get the best. Then when these people invent something, it's invented in America. Now, in this discussion, what the leaders of the continent said, I'm not sure if they have done that. They said there must be a collaboration about different skills by the universities in Africa. I don't know how far they've gone. But they also said the African diaspora, wherever it is, in the Caribbean, in the USA, in Europe, must also collaborate, because you can still link up with an Ali Mazrui, wherever they are, and say, this is what we think
can happen. And I know many people may not like what the example I want to give, because I don't always agree with them. You see, the South African Jewish Board, not only it, I think it is based elsewhere, but it has a network all over the world for their own interest. And I don't always agree with their interest. But the networking is actually something you can borrow. But what they are doing might be something else. And I think the African people in the continent are not networking on things that can be their own interest sufficiently at the level of the continent and at the level of the world without going back home, because it's no longer possible. The last one.
The African diaspora is regarded as the seventh region of the AU.
Is it regarded?
As the seventh region of the AU. Sixth
yeah.
region of the AU.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The other one, which is also a bit extraneous, but also very related. This one is not quite extraneous. Very related. And it is that the concern raised by media and some people in the world, including in South Africa, and some of whom are in the opposition, about the withdrawal from the ICC, which will lead to impunity. We don't agree with the reasons, but they are not, the concerns are not misplaced. They are not misplaced because, you see, what should be and is a challenge to the leadership of the continent is that when they withdraw from the ICC, what do they replace the ICC with? Should genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes happen, such as has happened, not outside the continent, inside the continent? When anyone in the continent, the future president, or whoever does these kind of things, where do you take them to try them? I know in Senegal they have done this thing. But that is the challenge that must be there. So that when people say, well, you have withdrawn there so that you can do these things with impunity. And just as a digression, there's a joke I'm sure you remember about President Mangope after they got independence. And then they had a high court where they could sentence people to death. In his public address, he says, our people will no longer go to apartheid South Africa to be hung there. We'll hang them ourselves. So if the leadership of the continent says, don't and go and be tried in the, in quotes, that white man's court or in quotes, colonial court, but for the same crime, you must also be tried by Pulaelewe. Yeah, so those were some of the things I wanted to talk about as part of the way forward. Over to you. And if the department, if you can speak to these things either here or outside, this is the way forward, so that we can see how we can link up. Over to you.
No, thanks, Chair, but my colleagues have dealt with a lot of the issues, and I can see, as usual, when we come and discuss such a broad issues, by its very nature, we miss out in detailed discussion on specifics. And now we've run out of time, unfortunately. But you've summed up a lot of the things. Let me just make a few general points, actually. I think all the African challenges we've talked about, conflicts, brain drain, we must also, as we deal with it, look at the challenges we have in Africa about governance and leadership deficit. Because, and that links up to developmental agenda for Africa. Because people don't leave because they like the cold weather abroad. They lose because they have better opportunities, skills are leaving. So we must always have in mind what is our own self-correction we need to do to deal with these challenges. We tried in the old days to talk to the, because at that time most of our people, nurses and that, were going to UK to talk to them, and for one certain period the then Labour government said, okay, we'll cut on the numbers. But it comes and then it starts again. And because of the globalized world, you're not going to prevent those who cannot find an opportunity in our own continent, and there's conflicts, not to go. There's no way you can stop them by legislation. I just want to broadly say that. Second, let me say that, and we can't elaborate, we'll have to go in. We must accept that South Africa's future, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, is inextricably linked to what happens on the continent. Vasu has hinted in our own region there are five potential explosions coming. Who will be the country to be impacted on? It will be South Africa. You can expect a rush from Zimbabwe, you can expect a rush, whether it's even now people are coming here illegally, many people from Taiwan, People's Republic. And so it's Africa with all its problems remains our challenge. And I accept that we no longer have the resources at this moment to do what we could do immediately post-94. That's reality now. I mean, if you see our GDP, we are slowly getting to a stage, I think, where there will be what we've been fearing, IMF imposed structural adjustments, because our growth is not matching with the money we are spending, and that's why you get structural adjustment imposed on you, and that will give rise to a lot of instability in this country. Look, I mean, the national interest is a debate that honestly you can have till it will come out. Let me say three things on that. There is a document cabinet approved of, at least it can be our guideline for a while. Now we have to put pressure to circulate this national interest. Cabinet cannot have accepted it and it's still secret. It's a cabinet decision. Secondly, we have our Bill of Rights. We have our constitution. Actually, which gives us the broad parameters of what we can use to define a nation. Doesn't mean everybody will agree. But we can define our national interests without... I think we must get that cabinet document and even enrich it. Because I think this sort of discussion can enrich a cabinet document too, by the way. Finally, let me say that you must understand, as we want to expand, we have serious budgetary restraints in the council. If it was not for DDE Joyeni, who's come in, and her team, we could not have resources to even come and visit Parliament, etc., or do other work. So we have to then discuss how we deal with this budget. We'll discuss it with the government. And, you know, the message will go from Sakawa and by DDE Joyeni, who's and her team who saved us. But a message to the minister that Sakawa needs to be given the budget to interact with Parliament and the outreach program in order to achieve what everybody is saying we must try to achieve. As you could hear, everybody is involved in other activity and nobody's full-time. And the fact that it's a pity two people pulled out last minute, that so many people said, no, talking to Parliament is what we've been asking for a long time, but other things have. So let's look at this a little more in detail. And finally, let me say that it was raised that we are not giving sufficient attention to the Middle East peace process. And the failure to do this is going to be the ignition that will light the explosive situation in the Middle East. I can't say this too openly, but the Middle East peace process is now in the, what they call, intensive care ward. Yeah. And then everybody, when they talk in on all sides, are saying, no, we all know the change in the facts of the ground and all that. So we know all that, the repression. But it's still our interest to to try to save what everybody thinks is unsavable. Now, we don't have to differ. There's United Nations resolutions. All our parties have got a resolution on a negotiated two-party solution. We can debate whether two-state solution is possible or not, but the Palestinians have asked for that. The Oslo Accords, the UN Security Council, the European Union, those are policies at the moment. So while I might have my own position about whether a two-state solution is not possible, it's something that is what unites everybody, even in that region, and we must work to achieve a negotiated... Well, let's work. We can't say it's on the intensive care, so we let it go to the cemetery. Let's bring it back from intensive care into the recovery ward. And I think we need to discuss that Middle East situation a little more in detail, in the context of what is happening in the whole region. You can't divorce the Middle East from what's happening in the region, actually. So it's like I'm saying now, as you've identified, our next meeting must have no more general, we have itemized agenda. Zimbabwe, etc. And restructuring of the institutions. The UN, whatever criticisms we have, let me honestly say, represents every country in the world. And it is still a very, with all these problems, important terrain to represent the ideas of the weaker countries. And we've always believed that it is an organization to defend the interests of the weaker countries. Our criticisms of the UN must not lead us to go into the section that we say the UN is irrelevant, get rid of it. We must fight for the changes. I don't know whether you remember the American representative at the UN, Bolton, who I see today is likely to come back into the Trump government. He said, no, we must close this UN down. It's a tyranny of the majority. Well, you know, we want the tyranny of the majority. And if he wants to close down the tyranny of the majority, his vested interests won't allow them to close the UN down because they can see it's a terrain of struggle. So, on that note, again, on behalf of our group, say that we find this discussion quite stimulating. It enriches our own views. As you can see, we're discussing a lot. We've only had 3 meetings, by the way. And we've discussed most of these issues we have been raising. And we think we need to have more meetings as the council. We think the outreach program is absolutely necessary. But as Vasu said, we can't go to the masses. We can go to constituencies, leaders of the masses. We can have mass meetings. I mean, it's not reasonable. We are discussing very serious foreign policy, complex issues. But we can go to the leaders. At all levels, national, provincial, and we can talk to the political organizations because in theory they're supposed to represent the interests of the people. So we are very keen to do that. It is one of our mandates. We are hoping to have meetings with other civil society groups so we can go into partnerships because civil society groups have a lot of money. And as long as they don't want to dictate our agenda, we will partner with them so that they can put some of the budget to hold. DECO has the PROW policy unit, and we're discussing with PROW how we can work together to have joint round tables, which will help us deal with the budget without trying to seek more money, because we know cost cutting is now the mantra of all government departments. So let's try to work on that basis, and I think your thoughts are captured, and all your thoughts have been captured. I think so. We'll look at it, and we will now go back. I think the council has to meet before the silly season comes, December. We have to meet sometime in December, review this meeting, and more focused discuss how we're going to be done. To repeat an old man who once said, what is to be done? That's what we hope to do now, and I hope it will then be in consultation. And we will seek your guys' support to convince the leadership that Sakawa can be an important player, and they have to then give it the attention it needs. Thank goodness for the DDG and her team. She's a recent arrival that we have now seriously started to work. I don't give my colleagues another chance.
No.
We'll be here till tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of Sakwaya. And with that, on behalf of the committee, let's take this opportunity to thank you for your valued inputs, taking into account that we have made certain suggestions that tell us how we want to be invited by. I was talking to party caucus, it's a listing of 6 months. We just look at that, let's refine that, and the other one on provincial focal persons, on structures, on networks. And I also want to thank members of the committee. And you know, to those who are saying different things, I just want to say something here. Honorable Mukhalapa. In the committee and everywhere else, we must allow people to express views and respect views. The nice thing about, or the good thing about South Africa, is that when ambassadors, at least to the extent that I can remember, when ambassadors were appointed, they have been appointed, not only the career ambassadors, appointed across the parties. And we have never had incidents where an ambassador, because he or she comes from another party, was unable to speak for the country, at least to the extent that I know. It was not because they came from another party. And even between 1994-99, those who came from the National Party, either as party members or as career diplomats, they still spoke for South Africa, subject to consultation from them. What do we say on this matter? So I'm just saying, it is good, we must know who, why people hold certain views, but they are still South African. Yeah, so I thought with that, the meeting is adjourned. And thank you very much. Lady G, on the way forward, yeah?
Honorable Chair and honorable members, this was really a very important session for us as a department to see all what we could do to support Sakwaya in order to effectively discharge its responsibilities independently, and we take note of all what we are required to do. We'll work towards achieving that and assisting where we can, and also to learn from whatever it is that we need to do, so that it is the first time. And me being in this role, obviously, I've benefited a lot from the exercise, and I realize how much we can not have contributed to children like this. It is a good lesson for us, and we commit to making sure that it happens. We thank you so much.
Announcement by the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chair. The meeting is invited to lunch at the members' restaurant in Max Building.
Oh, Chair, can I file out? Jump on the order.
Yeah. We were scheduled to have a briefing on the outcome of the U.S. elections, and it disappeared in the radar. But what happened?
Oh, by the way, yeah, my apology. We noted that this was going to be a long-drawn discussion because it was going to straddle on a litany of issues the whole world. It was
the first engagement, and it was not going to be pointed, as the chair was indicating, that next time when we invite them, we must say Syria, Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
So it will be more pointed. Now, I think I want to apologize that we then said we're going to deny ourselves time, and we're supposed to have lunch with them. The lunch is held in their honor, and then we must have preparation for the debate in the afternoon. I want to apologize. Members are invited to lunch. You will guide us.
Yes, sir. I'll lead you.
Thank you very much.
No.
Yeah.